You can see from the map the relationship between the Ephraim and where the war was actually fought against the Ammonites over this area. The Ephraimites always showed up when the battle was over. Now this is the third time they've shown their true colors as crybabies. They cried to Joshua, "We didn't get big enough piece of ground." They cried to Gideon, "Why didn't you bring us down here to help fight, win the glory here against the Midianites?" Now they're griping against Jephthah. "Why didn't you have us over here fighting with you in this campaign?" And Jephthah responds to them by saying, in effect, "Well, I did ask you. I called upon you. I needed your help. You didn't show up. So I risked my own life and undertook this campaign by myself. Now quit bugging me. Why are you over here causing me a lot of problems?" Well, the Ephraimites made war against Jephthah and his Gileadites. The term Gileadite is used for all these people now apparently living over here. It appears to me that the Ephraimites launched this war. It says Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead and fought Ephraim. Well, I don't know. The Ephraimites were over across the river. I assume that's an act of aggression. It doesn't really spell it out that they were the first ones to start fighting, but they were certainly not in their place, and they were causing a big stink. So Jephthah and his Gileadites just took them on. And they cut off the fords of the Jordan here, and what word did he make them say to get back across the Jordan? Shibboleth. And the Ephraimites could not say Shibboleth. Every time they tried to say Shibboleth, it came out Sibboleth. They couldn't say Sh. I had a fellow in graduate study with me in Hebrew Union College that could not pronounce the Hebrew letter that's supposed to be pronounced Sh. It would come out Sut every time. If he'd lived back in Jephthah's day, he would have made it. The word Shibboleth is a Hebrew word that means a grain. The meaning of the word is not important. But to this day, that's one Hebrew word that has come down into English. In English today, what do we mean? We say somebody requires a shibboleth. You ever heard that expression? No. It's in literature. What is a shibboleth? Well, it's a cliche or a password or a phrase or a doctrine or a belief that you must adhere to and say in order to be accepted as part of a group. And so that's the way the word is still used today. It's one of very few Hebrew words that's come over into English. So it's important that just for your general education, it doesn't have anything to do with this class, but for your general education to know how the word shibboleth is used. And it all goes back to this story where if you couldn't pronounce the word shibboleth, it came out sibboleth. You had it. So this also indicates, by the way, that there were certain dialectical differences between the various tribes. They didn't all pronounce the words exactly the same. Just like up in East Tennessee, where we speak pure, unadulterated English, and we come out of that area into other parts of the country and hear the way you people with your terrible accents mispronounce words. Don't draw them out like you're supposed to. Don't talk through your nose like you're supposed to. You see, you don't know how to speak English until you've been raised in East Tennessee. Well, in every part of the country, you have your little quirks in dialect, and that's the same here, back here in the Bible days. 42,000 people were killed. By the way, the word used here for kill is not the ordinary word used for killing in time of war, but rather it's the Hebrew word that implies cold-blooded murder. Jephthah and his men guarded the river. They wouldn't let them back across lest they could pronounce this word, shibboleth. And as far as the biblical writer is concerned, that was cold-blooded murder. It wasn't a justifiable act of death in time of war, for example. Say goodbye to Jephthah, the man who made a stupid vow. No matter what your interpretation of the daughter is concerned, Jephthah made a rash vow. He kept his vow in some way or the other, But he certainly made a stupid vow, and that's what we remember him by. A man who made a rash vow, and then he teaches us the lesson to be very careful about what we say we're going to do, and what we pledge we're going to do, and the vows we take. Okay, two or three little minor judges here that don't amount to do a whole lot. Ibzan from Bethlehem. About the only thing I want to call your attention to here, he had 30 daughters that he married off to foreigners, and he took 30 foreign wives for his sons. Now, the point I want to bring out is these judges are starting to act a great deal like kings, the way they're operating. What is that I hear clicking?
Scott's tape recorder.
Scott's tape recorder? He's got termites in it or something. Elon of Zebulun, know nothing about him. Abdon, the Ephraimite, again, he had 40 sons and 30 grandsons, or some versions say nephews, that rode on 70 donkeys. Here again, you see how what we started out with a very simple picture with Deborah judging the tribes of Israel under a palm tree. Now we're seeing these judges with enormous families, which imply a harem of wives, and apparently wealth. It would take some wealth to accumulate all these donkeys and all that sort of thing, implying that they're using their own sons to help rule the country. Do you have a question, Kelly?
Yeah, it wasn't. What does God think about having more than one wife? Was that acceptable?
Well, it was never his intention from the beginning, but it was tolerated, put it that way. Toleration does not necessarily imply approval. You know, some things I tolerate, I don't necessarily approve of. Yes.
Did these 30 sons marry outside of the tribes?
Apparently so, in the one case. Foreigners. No, I think Gentiles, foreigners. And again, it implies that some of these judges were not exactly in tune with the Lord spiritually. Well, we don't know much about these judges, but I do think it's important that you have the list of judges memorized. 12 of them in the book of Judges, 2 more that we're going to study about when we come to the book of Samuel. Let's name them down to this point. Mr. G, take us as far as you can go with the judges. Who can take them down, Freddie?
I will. Ethan, Shamgar, Deborah.
Gideon.
Hello,
Jer,
Jephthah.
Elon. Ibzan. Elon. Abdon. Samson. Oh, Samson. Okay. Let's talk about Samson. He's a very interesting character. By the way things are shaking up, looks like a major test on Monday, folks. Have a good weekend. Major test on Monday, and you will never have seen a test like I'm giving you. Totally different. It is neither. It is neither matching. It is not true and false. It is not discussion. I warn you in advance, it will have a map on it to put on the tribes. I'll just tell you that much of it. You have to be able to put the tribes in the right places. That's all I'm going to tell you. I think you'll enjoy this text.
No true and false.
That's right.
No discussion,
true and false or matching. Right. No multiple choice. No multiple choice. It's all fill in the blank except the math part.
Oh.
Yes.
Abimelech won the judge.
I do not know. Good question has been asked up here. Was Abimelech a judge? Number one, he's not called a judge, nor does it say that he judged Israel.
Okay.
He was a king in a crude sense of the word, but he was a somewhat of a king over at least a small area. I don't consider him a judge. Now, some writers do. Some writers also consider Barak a judge. But he's not called a judge, nor does it say he judged Israel. So I don't include him on the list either. Yes?
Is there some writers that think Boaz was a judge by a different name.
I've never heard that before. I don't recall hearing that before.
Okay.
All right. It wouldn't surprise me. There's some writers that think anything.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about the birth of Samson. The Philistines have now come into the land. We have moved over 300 years in our course so far, believe it or not. And the Philistines swept into the land of Israel sometime around about the year 1200, and we're a little bit after that. We're down about 1090 is where the Philistine oppression began. They didn't oppress Israel from right off the bat, but about 1090 they began to oppress the people of God. And to bring about the deliverance from the Philistines, the angel of the Lord began his appearances once again. And he appeared first to the wife of Manoah. We don't know her name. She was barren. She is told she's going to have a son. He will be a Nazarite from his birth. Now, last quarter we learned some of the characteristics of a Nazarite. Who recalls what the basic rules of the Nazarite vow were? Dan?
They weren't present
here. Well, not only that, they weren't to touch anything that came from the vine. And not even grapes or raisins. Boy, that goes. Well, of course, none of them were to do that. Not to touch a dead body. That's the third. Okay? So the hair, no cut. The no touching of something dead, being in the presence of something that's dead or touching it, and no drinking a strong drink or anything from the fruit of the vine. Okay. Now, Samson was to be raised as a Nazarite. Look at verse 5, an extremely important verse. I want you to underline some words there. It says, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God. Okay, we've talked about that, underlined that. And he shall, get this, begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Samson never completed delivering the land from the hand of the Philistines. I mean, he inflicted some mighty blows against them. He weakened them, but he did not succeed in delivering the land from the Philistines. In that sense, he's the only one of the judges that did not succeed. Because all the others succeeded in bringing rest to the land. Samson did not. It remained for his successor Samuel to accomplish what Samson could not do through strength. Samuel was able to do through prayer. At any rate, and that's an important statement there to underline. Now the woman reported what had happened to her husband. She said, a man appeared to me like the angel of God. She wasn't quite sure. Now that tells us that when this angel appeared, he didn't have a halo, didn't have wings. He looked like an ordinary person, ordinary man. She tells her husband, he's a little bit skeptical, but he prays for the reappearance of this man of God with further instructions. And sure enough, he showed up again. This time, the woman fetches her husband. And Manoah asked the angel, what shall be the manner of this boy's life? Well, the angel really doesn't give any additional instruction, except that he just tells him he's to raise him as a Nazarite. But Manoah suggests that he give him an offering, a meal rather, serve him a meal. And the angel says, well, I won't eat a meal, but I do think it's appropriate if you offer up an offering to the Lord. Now, offering an offering to the Lord away from where the altar was at the tabernacle was a no-no. Manoah must have realized right then that he was talking to some extraordinary person. That he would give instructions for an offering to be made to the Lord right there on the spot. So he goes and he prepares this offering, he brings it out. Meanwhile, he asked this angel his name. What is your name? He said, my name is Wonderful. Same name used in Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6 of the Messiah. His name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. My name is Wonderful, Incomprehensible is the idea. You wouldn't understand it if I told it to you. And there again, I think Manoah is now convinced that the one he's talking to is this angel of the Lord, this theophany that we've talked about. And then he places his offering on the rock. What did the angel do? He touches what? Does the angel produce the fire here? Or does Manoah produce the fire? Yeah, it looks like Manoah does, doesn't it? I'm trying to contrast this with the story we had, what was it, yesterday, before yesterday, and the reference to Gideon. In the Gideon account, the angel touched the rock and the fire went up, right? In this account, it would appear that Manoah built an ordinary fire, but then the angel what? Goes up in the flames. Did the angel go up in the flames back there when he appeared to Gideon? No, he just disappeared. He may have gone up in the flame, but just says he disappeared. So there, the two incidents are similar, and yet there are details that are different in the appearance of this angel of the Lord to Gideon and the appearance of this angel of the Lord to Manoah. Manoah fell on his face. It says in verse 21 that he knew it was the angel of the Lord. And then look at the next verse. We shall surely die, for we have seen God. Did you pick up on that? Those of you that may have some lingering doubts about this angel of the Lord being a theophany, notice the reaction of Manoah. We have seen God, he says. And he feels like that he's doomed because he's looked upon the face of God. Well, Samson is born as the Lord promised. His name Samson is related to the Hebrew word Shemesh. It means sun. So I think we could probably say that Samson's name means bright, brightness, or just plain sunshine. He wasn't too bright, though, was he? And verse 25 tells us that the Spirit of God began to stir him. I love that verse. The Spirit of the Lord began to stir him as he comes to maturity and gains his strength. Now then, in his travels about the country, Samson finds a woman down at Timnath. Let me put up here a map of Samson's activities, and we'll sort of trace him around the country today. You can see from this map that Samson's home here is in Zorah. Timnah is very close here. This is where he saw the Philistine woman. Notice that you have a Philistine village and an Israelite village just a few miles apart on the scale there of that map. That's far less than 10 miles. Looks like more like about maybe 6 miles or so away. And so that's the situation we're in this period of history. You have Israelite villages, Philistine villages, and places that are just virtually side by side. So he sees this Philistine woman. And what was it that attracted him to her?
Right, her beauty.
What?
Her beauty, her physical.
Exactly correct. He goes back to his parents. He says, get her for me, for she looks good to me. It's obvious that his ultimate concerns were not spiritual. His parents said, is there no woman to suit you among all of our people? And Samson says, no. Now, verse 4 is the verse I want you to look at because I think we need to understand it properly. However, his father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord. For he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Now, at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel. Now, the point here, it was of the Lord. You mean to tell me that God approves of his people after all that he said back there in the law about not marrying foreign women and all of that sort of thing? Are we to understand this to mean that God approved of what Samson was doing here, of his lust? And let's face it, that's all it is, isn't it? Guy hasn't even been out with her on a date yet. And he wants to marry her strictly on the basis of appearances. I call that lust. How do you answer my question? It says this was of the Lord. In what sense was this of the Lord? Mark.
It's just permissive
will. Well, I think so. Providentially, this is coming about providentially. It's all part of God's plan. Please don't understand verse 4 to mean that God is putting his stamp of approval upon this man's lust and upon his willingness to disregard the law which says you're to marry only within your own people, not to marry unbelievers. She obviously is an unbeliever. So it must have something to do with the idea that this is all part of God's providence. Now, how do we fit that together? Here's the situation. The Israelites now have been dominated by the Philistines for a number of years. The Israelites showed no inclination to throw off the yoke. They were all intimidated by the Philistines. So, because Israel did not have any gumption, any willpower, they'd rather be Philistine than dead, God decided to raise up an individual who had a personal grudge. Now, sometimes people won't fight until they get a personal grudge, until they get a stake in it, you see. You've got people right now in America who will not fight for the freedom of our country unless they get a personal stake in it. So God raises up Samson. Now Samson is a hothead. He's a man filled with lust. But God worked through him because he developed a monumental hatred for the Philistines. And we're going to see why here in just a moment. You already know why, but let's go on through it here. So the Bible says that the father and mother of Samson went down to Timnath with Samson to make the marriage arrangements. A lion came out against Samson. Now whether he's walking ahead of his parents or what, it says they did not realize he had killed this lion. It roared against him, and with his bare hands he kills the lion. Now, that's going to figure into the story in a moment. Verse 6 says, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. In the period of the judges, one of the manifestations of the Spirit of the Lord, I say one of the manifestations, was superhuman strength. And that is what we're seeing right here. Now later then, he returns to claim his bride. Well, there's one other thing I wanted to point out here. Where is it where he talks to her? What verse is it? Where he goes down. Yeah, verse 7. Well, I don't have that in my notes. So he went down and he talked to the woman. And she looked good, Samson. Second emphasis on the fact that Samson's choice of a mate was based strictly upon external qualities. Skin-deep qualities. And he made a tragic mistake here. So when they go back for the wedding feast, Samson notices that this carcass of the lion, bees have made some honey in it. And he goes over and he takes some of the honey and tastes of it. He breaks the first vow of his Nazarite vow. For as a Nazarite, he is not supposed to touch anything that's dead. Vow number one is broken at this point. They have a week-long marriage feast. Now, occasionally you will hear it said that people in Bible days did not have marriage ceremonies. They just began to live together. I submit to you that is not true. I know you can't document in every single situation that there was a formal marriage ceremony. It may have been quite different from what we're familiar with today. But my research indicates that marriage has always, as far back as you can go, has always been viewed as a formal covenant relationship. And whenever you have a covenant, you have some sort of a solemn ceremony to bring that covenant to the eye of the public. And I submit to you that at least as far as the people of God is concerned, there never was a time when marriage was just simply two people starting to live together. And I submit to you that there's something more important in a marriage license than just a piece of paper. A marriage is a formal commitment made publicly to society and to God that two people are going to covenant to live together till they die. That's a solemn covenant. And even with this Philistine, even with the Philistine culture, apparently there was some sort of a marriage ceremony, if you please, a week-long celebration here, a feast. Now, the word used here for feast is the Hebrew word mishteh, which means a drinking feast. Unless we want to think that Samson sat there the whole week and didn't touch any booze, which I think would be highly unlikely, the feast was in his honor. I suggest to you that here vow number two was broken. A Nazarite was not to touch hard liquor. This obviously was a drinking feast as part of the marriage celebration. He's outnumbered, isn't he? No indication that any Israelite men were even there at the celebration, but there were 30 Philistine companions there for the woman on the other side. They'd been invited by the woman. And during the course of the feast, Samson, probably under the influence of a little bit of booze, said, "I've got a riddle for you. If you can solve this riddle, I'll give you all a change of garments." And the riddle is translated in the New American Standard Bible in poetry. It's one of the Hebrew writers do not use rhyme very frequently. Here's one of the few cases in the Bible where you have rhyme used by a writer. So Samson was a poet in our sense of the word. Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. That was his little rhyming riddle. And they couldn't figure it out. 4 days into the feast, they start getting worried. Who do they put the pressure on? Who does she put the pressure on?
"Oh, if you really love me, you tell me. You don't really love me. You don't trust me."
What man alive could resist a week of that? Greenwood? Come back and see me about 10 years from now, Greenwood. I want to talk to you. So finally, on the seventh day, he tells his wife. She runs right over and tells her Philistine buddies. They come right out and answer the riddle, and now Samson is under obligation to provide them each with a change of garments. He again gives a rhyme. "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have discovered my riddle," which isn't very much rhyme in English, but does rhyme in Hebrew. So Samson, you see, was the Muhammad Ali of the Old Testament. He had rotten poetry. Yes, Kelly? Yes. Well, we talk about a woman today being a fox. Or a filly. Or what else? What are some of the new terms? A what? A pig. What did you say?
A dog.
A dog. Well, it seems that all through history, men have had, and women too for that matter, have had the custom of referring to the opposite sex by certain favorite animals. The animals have differed from age to age. In the Song of Solomon, Solomon says to his woman he's trying to woo, he says, "You have, your hair looks like a string of goats coming down the side of Mount Hermon." Most of you girls would slap a guy and say that to you. That was meant to be a compliment. He said, "You have teeth like sheep going down into the to wash. They're all even. Not one of them's out of place." Meant to be a compliment. You know? Okay, yes. Oh, you mean who got the Zeeb Award?
Yeah.
Well, I asked the committee chairwoman, and she's still pondering. She's got it narrowed down to two. Did you want to make a campaign speech? No. Well, okay. Vicki's going to let us know when she's ready to announce it. Friday. Tomorrow's Friday. No, tomorrow's Thursday. We don't meet tomorrow. Friday, okay. And we'll have a little notebook paper plaque for you to hang up in your room. Testimony to the confidence of all the girls that whoever it is gets the Zeeb Award. I just trust it won't be one of the married fellows.
Yeah.
Yes?
The answer to the list is also a rhyme form in the Hebrew?
No. No, it is not. No, they just answer the riddle in prose. All right, where did Samson get the garments to pay off his wager? He's a poor country boy. He has no money. Trots down to Ashkelon. Good ways, about 23 miles. Philistines start disappearing off the streets that night. One into a doorway, another behind a bush. All over town, people are disappearing. Naked corpses are found laying all over the streets of Ashkelon. Samson carries this bundle of garments back up there to Timnah and dumps them in front of the people and says, let it be known that I pay my debts. Well, he paid his debts at the expense of the Philistine. Now, here again, there's no indication that God approves of the tactics that Samson uses. This is cold-blooded murder. Really? But here again, no one else is doing anything to inflict any pain upon the Philistines, and they are oppressing the people of God, and so this is the beginning of a lifelong feud between Samson and the Philistines. Okay, well, Samson goes home to cool off, comes back to claim his bride. The father said, well, I didn't think you were coming back, so I gave her to your best man. And Samson was ready to blow a fuse at that point. So the father says, is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? Samson looked over there.
You gotta be kidding.
Yeah, that was dear. Now, some writers have speculated that this younger sister grew up to be Delilah, but that's pure speculation. That's the way it was in the movie, if you remember the movie Samson and Delilah. The younger sister, you know, who was ugly and he didn't want, grows up to be the delectable, delightful, enticing Delilah. But that's just speculation. No way to prove that. Yes.
Oh,
wait, that's my question. I thought up that question in my office this morning. I haven't gotten to Delilah yet. You think about it. I'll ask you. All right, now. So, Samson takes revenge again on the Philistines. This time he destroys their grain fields a rather unique way. He catches 300 foxes, I mean the four-legged kind, or jackals, as some translations put it. He ties firebrands to their tails, ties them tail to tail and puts a firebrand, so they ran all over the place, back and forth, pulling each other through the grain field, till all the grain in the land of the Philistines was burned to a crisp. Boy, that really hit them where it hurt. The vineyards, the olives were destroyed, the grain crops. The Philistines retaliated by coming up into Israel, burning the home of Samson's wife. Now, that always seemed to me to be very curious. I'm not quite sure why they burned her and her dad. I mean, she didn't have anything to do with Samson anymore. You remember, the threat that the Philistines made against her was that if she didn't tell them the riddle, they were going to burn her house down. So she told them the riddle and got her house burned down anyway. So there's a little bit of irony in this whole thing. Then it tells us that Samson goes over here to a place over in the Judean wilderness. Now this area here is all wilderness. You've never seen anything like that in your life. You go on your Holy Land trip, you'll go down through this area and you'll see this area. And it's just indescribable. But don't criticize it. I made that mistake on one trip. I said, this is the most godforsaken, barren, desolate piece of real estate I've ever laid my eyes on when the guide about went into orbit. She said, this is beautiful.
Okay.
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, I guess. But anyway, that's where he is. Down here for a time near a place called Edom. The Philistines bring an army of some 3,000 men a large army up into Israel, and they say, we want Samson, and if you don't give us Samson, you've had it. So 3,000 of the men of Judah seek out Samson, and they begin to blame him. What have you done to it? Look at all the trouble you've brought to us. And Samson responds in verse 11. He said, well, I've just done what they've done to me. And they say, well, we've got to turn you over to the Philistines. And he said, well, promise me you won't kill me and I'll submit. Tie me up. And they said, all right. So they tie him up. They take him to where the Philistines are located, up into this area. So they had a pretty good ways to take him. And when he gets into what appears to me at least, a kind of a narrow pass, he spots a jawbone there. He thinks, that may be a good weapon. Of course, all the Philistines are jeering and laughing as he comes up. He snaps those ropes like they were nothing. Reaches down, picks up that jawbone, and commences flailing away right and left. And I picture him sort of standing in a narrow pass where the Philistines could only come at him maybe one or two at a time. And they just kept coming until the bodies started piling up. Somebody carry off the bodies and bring on another 50 of them. And he takes this weapon and slays 1,000 men. Now some writers think that maybe he didn't do all the slaying himself. Some people think that when he picked up the jawbone, the men of Israel maybe got up courage, helped him. But the scripture seems to imply that he did it all himself. At least he takes credit for it, doesn't he? And when he's all through, he's thirsty, as you might well expect, and they didn't have any coolers out there in Lehi, so God gave him water from the rock there, didn't he, to take care of his thirst. All right. Now, the next place we see Samson in chapter 16 is pretty sad. We see Samson now going down to Gaza, which is another Philistine city. You wonder how he would even have the courage to travel in that region, Mr. Lyon.
Why only 1,000 men?
Why only 1,000? Well, maybe the rest of them got the message and went home. Or maybe the 3,000 Jews chased them home. I mean, you know, I don't know. I can't really answer your question. Why only 1,000? I mean, a guy killed 1,000 men with nothing but a jawbone in his hand? Well, I'm tired. No, why only 1,000? I have a hunch if 1,002 had come at him, he'd have taken care of the other two also. But anyway, he goes down here to Gaza, to a harlot's house. Here's a man who's a Nazarite. A Nazarite was supposed to be one who was a living example of dedication and commitment to the Lord. And here he is visiting in the house of a harlot. And the very fact that he could go to Gaza suggests that the Philistines were totally intimidated by him. He had no fear of walking right down into their own territory, apparently. But at nighttime, they surrounded the house, and they thought, now in the morning, when he walks out of there, we'll get him. As it turned out, they should have gone in that night. I don't know why they didn't. But they decided to wait till morning. Meanwhile, he peeked out the window and saw him hiding out there. Slips out in the dead of night, goes to the city of Gaza, rips the doors off the gate, puts them on his shoulders, and carries them up to Hebron. Or at least the mountain that was opposite Hebron. Now, that's a long way. Where's Hebron? Over here. It doesn't say he actually took them to Hebron, but it says he took them on a mountain opposite Hebron. Now, if you went all the way to Hebron, let's see. I did some research on that somewhere. The distance would be, where did I have that? The distance to Hebron would be 30 miles if he went all the way to Hebron. Now, it doesn't actually say he went all the way, it just says to a mountain opposite Hebron. But anyway, however you slice it, he carried those gates for a good ways. A tremendous feat of strength, Mr. Greenwood.
Do you have any record of how big they were?
Well, you can judge by, you know, the archaeological finds at various cities. I don't know if they found these particular gates or not. I'd have to look that up. But most all the city gates were, at least the door part, was pretty much the same. They were wooden, but they would be tremendously heavy. They wouldn't be hollow. They'd be solid wood doors, and they'd be huge. They'd probably be 7 to 9 feet tall, at least. Probably reinforced with iron, wouldn't doubt it a bit.
Why?
Why?
Why'd you do that?
Well, that's a good question. Why did he do that? Psychological warfare? Nobody's going to go up against somebody who can rip the gates off your city. I don't know. Maybe he grabbed them into toothpicks or something. No. He just did it. Who can explain it, Mr. Sunshine here? Yeah. One of the Sunshine Boys. Mr. G's got an explanation back there, I'm sure. Yeah, but I'm sure they replaced it the next day or as soon as possible. I think it was just an act of intimidation, just to kind of warn him, boy, don't mess with me. All right, be sure you can list the women in the lives of Samson. His wife at Timnah, the harlot at Gaza, and now we meet number 3, the famous Delilah, who lived in the valley of Sorek. Now we come to Lisa's question, which was about 10 minutes premature. Lisa. Good question. Answer, we don't know for sure. I'm being honest, I could fake you out. We don't know. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows whether she was an Israelite woman employed by the Philistines or whether she was a Philistine woman. I don't know. I'm inclined to think she was a Philistine. Samson seemed to be attracted for some reason to Philistine women. Now, the Philistine women that I've seen on the monuments, I can't imagine anybody being attracted to. Well, there again, you should see it. But anyway, he was. It always seems like you're attracted to that which you are not supposed to have, I suppose. And so here is Delilah now. How much did they promise to pay her if she got his secret? Each of them, and it doesn't say how many. Does it say how many? I kept thinking it said there were five of them, but I couldn't find it when I read back through there. Does it say five? It doesn't say, does it? There were five major Philistine cities, and probably there were five of these characters, each of them promising her 1,100 pieces of silver. You remember when we studied the case of the Levite? How much was the Levite going to get paid for a whole year of serving as priest in the home of Micah? Do you remember? Ten pieces of silver for a whole year plus a change of garments, a new suit. That was all he got. This woman is promised five times 1,100 pieces of silver. I mean, that's quite a retirement program. She'd be fixed for the rest of her days with that kind of loot. Okay? So she begins to entice Samson, and he tells her three lies. You better be able to list the three lies. What was the first one? Fresh cords or green withes, as the King James puts it. Second lie, new ropes. Third lie, weave the hair together, getting closer to the truth. And then finally, the truth comes out as the Bible says, verse 16, she pressed him daily. And finally, she puts him to sleep with his head upon her lap and has her servant come in and cut off his hair. And here, ladies and gentlemen, verse number 20 is the saddest verse I think we'll come across the entire term. But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. He thought everything was the same as it had always been. He jumps up. He's going to fight the Philistine just like he's done for years, just like he's done on three previous occasions right there at Delilah's house. No strength. God is gone. He didn't know it. You know, I was meditating on this verse this morning, and I just began to wonder. I wonder how many of you in this class are going to face a crisis sometime, perhaps very soon, perhaps more sooner than you think, and you're going to rise up and think that you have the spiritual strength to deal with the crisis and find out that the spiritual strength is gone. You didn't even know. That's a sad thing, isn't it? Oh, how easy it is to deceive ourselves. How easy it is to think that we can forget about our prayer life for a few days. How easy it is to think that we can read two chapters tomorrow to make up for the one chapter we don't want to read tonight. We're too tired. How easy it is to let the day slip by. How easy it is on Wednesday night to justify missing church, finding something else that we think we have to do. Well, I've got to study tonight. I can't go to church. And yet we find time to be around the pool, talking away the hours. How easy it is to begin to become dilatory in our spiritual exercise. We become spiritually flabby. And like Samson, we lose our strength. Vow number one, he broke when he touched the corpse of the lion. Vow number two, he broke when he was at the drinking feast. Vow number three, the last of the three major vows of the Nazarite, he breaks when he tells his secret to a devious woman and lets her cut him, permits her by his stupidity to cut his hair. Well, he was put in the prison house. His eyes were punched out. Brought to Gaza, bound in chains, made to grind grain like an ox. Now that means he wasn't totally without strength, because that in itself would take some strength. But his strength is that of an ordinary man, and not of the superhuman strength that he had. Festival there at the temple of Dagon, they bring him out, his hair has begun to grow back, he utters a prayer. Oh God, give me strength one last time. His arms are on the two supporting pillars, and he pushes them down. More people died in his death than died during his life. Sad story. 3,000 who were on the balcony died that day.
So that's the end of the story of Samson. A lot of lessons there for us to chew on and think about. Good practical applications to our lives. Warnings to be heeded. Let's don't forget Samson. Okay, Friday, Samuel, Eli, the Ark of God, and Monday, the big test.